Welcome to SLA, where you can learn to avoid gaslighting yourself and your language teaching practices,
break down academic gatekeeping on second language acquisition,
and girl boss your way through dynamic, engaging, and research-based language teaching.
I'm Ben Fisher Rodriguez, and my pronouns are he, him.
I'm Bill Langley, and my pronouns are he, him.
I'm Brian Smith, and my pronouns are he, they.
Let's slay. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Slay, Second Language Acquisition for Everyone. We are honored to have a special guest today who is going to share their wisdom and knowledge with us and who was highlighted as part of the ACTFL Teacher of the Year process. Kate Tsukumaki is the Washington Association for Language Teaching Teacher of the Year, the Pacific Northwest Council for Languages Teacher of the Year, and the ACTFL 2025 National Language Teacher of the Year. Kay, we are so excited to have you as a guest on our podcast. Hello, how are you?
I'm doing really well. Thank you so much for having me here.
We are so pleased to have you on the podcast and would love to put as a podcast a plug in for the Teachers of the Year programs. These are great ways to get to meet other educators, to reflect on your professional development and all sorts of things. So if you know somebody who is really crushing it out there, nominate them for an award. The best things that come of it are that they really feel really professionally embraced and hugged, speaking from experience. So Kay, please tell us a little bit about your teaching career, how you got to where you are now.
Yeah, of course. So I am third generation Japanese American, but I grew up speaking only English at home. So I was really fortunate to learn both Spanish and Japanese, starting Spanish in middle school, and then taking Japanese at high school and college. So I'm one of those people who always knew what I wanted to be, and I've always wanted to be a teacher. It's been really great for me to be able to teach Japanese. I added my Spanish endorsement back in 2019, so I'm certified to teach both. But currently I teach Japanese 1 through AP at a public high school, grades 9 through 12, here in Kirkland, Washington, just northeast of Seattle.
Slay. You also do some district level language program coordination, is that right?
Yes. This year I'm part-time working at my district office, helping support world language teachers and all the programs that we have in our district.
Amazing. And then you are traveling the nation as the ACTFL Teacher of the Year for 2025. How is that going so far?
Wonderful. The first conference I went to was at the end of January. I went to the Southwest Conference down in Phoenix. And like you were saying about the whole ACTFL Teacher of the Year program, really one of the greatest parts of this is getting to go around and meet other educators and learn from them. And these conferences are such great opportunities to see teachers who are teaching in very similar contexts, but also teachers who have very different contexts, and being able to see what ideas there are at all levels, right, from pre-K up through university. The three other conferences are in March, and then PNCFL is in April.
Yes, in Anchorage. So that'll be lots of good fun. So we invited you on the podcast because we know that you have a lot of professional expertise to share, and you wanted to share with us about creating positive classroom environments. And so Bill, Brian, and I are going to gaslight ourselves or speak of how we have previously gaslit ourselves in the process of trying to create positive classroom environments, but maybe failing at that or coming short of our ideals.
Sometimes I gaslight myself into thinking I'm funny.
Sometimes humor does not come off, depending on the developmental stage of your audience. You know, sometimes sarcasm literally doesn't register as anything other than meanness. And so you can think you're having some fun bantering and a student can take it super seriously. So yeah, developmental appropriateness, but also, because otherwise we are funny 100% of the time.
Yeah, no, I was talking more like they're trying to make me believe that I'm not funny. And
are they failing or winning?
Sometimes winning, sometimes failing, but I said from the beginning of the year to be cringe is to be free, and I am free.
I think that because I came in with a goodwill towards children generally, which I think should perhaps be a prerequisite. I don't know how exactly you would certify that in an exam, but I think I generally was like, I do like working with children, and like I think this is going to be great. And I think that in the beginning, I assumed that I could ride that goodwill and that sort of feeling that I was going to do a good job and that, you know, the vibes are going to be immaculate because, you know, I'm good at banter and I have fun. And I was trying to make it different from their other language classes or their other classes or whatever, that was going to take me where I wanted to go. And then you butt up against, you know, children are individual human beings coming to the classroom with a variety of experiences. And so some things worked, some things didn't. But I think the lack of, you know, like self-awareness in the process also impeded me from making the positive environment I wanted, because I thought it would just establish itself rather than me actually taking steps to establish it.
Yeah, so I know that we've mentioned a couple times on a couple different episodes about how, like, students, at least like in most of our contexts where they're starting to take language later, maybe in high school, middle school or high school, like, they know how to take a history class, they know how to take an English class, they know how to take a math class. And I think, like, yeah, my best intentions to make my class be the best version of it could be assumed that they would be able to just easily figure out this completely wild and different class. So finding balance and between the seriousness, I'm doing air quotes, the seriousness of school with like the playfulness of language.
I think about when I tried to implement like something I had seen while I was studying at the Concordia Language Villages in Minnesota. Shouts out to them, where they have language immersion programs for a lot of different languages in the summer and also a bit during the school year, different lengths, things like that. Anyway, one of the things that they do is that children wear like a name tag with their language name on it. And by choosing to be, they call it different things in different languages, but like language master, essentially, it's like you get to wear like a special lanyard that means that you commit to only speaking the language for a certain amount of time. And I was like, that's great. Like, these kids seem super pumped and motivated to use the language. And like, something about the idea that they're choosing to do it, it's not something that's being forced upon them, seemed to be in alignment with what I had, you know, been taught about how motivation should work in theory with students. And so I was like, I'm gonna take this back to my classroom and try it. So I had them all make little language master lanyards. And I said like, hey, if you want to, you can put it on and say, I'm committing to only speaking in French during class. And, you know, maybe the more people do that, like we can get some class rewards or something like that. And it was a disaster. I, you know, like at the camps, they would do like a little song when it was time to put it on. And like, everyone's like, you know, in the groove and like, it was something, it was like something
in cultural,
right. Something cultural was very present there that like, you can't really build from scratch. I don't know if that makes sense, but like there were some students who were just completely not into it at all. They didn't ever try. And then there were other students who were only into it for the singing part. And then like they'd put it on and then start speaking English anyway. And like, well, okay, well now you have to take it off. And like, it just became too much to manage. It didn't work. So I was like, we're not doing this anymore. And then it was funny because at some point this school year, a student was like, hey, why don't we do the language master thing anymore? I'm like, well, because it didn't work. And like, I could see the like wheels turning in their head. And I was like, yeah, it wasn't just a little fun song thing. I had actual reason for doing it, you know? And so I do think I still have a positive, generally positive class culture. It's just, I just know my students enough to know that something like that doesn't work with them. So,
yeah. I come into interaction sometimes too, thinking that students do know what it's for and why, and like also how to do stuff. Like I've been talking to my friend who is a teacher in California as well. And he's like, they misspelled the name of the book in the report. And I'm like, yeah, cause they do that sometimes. Or like, you know, it seems obvious that you shouldn't, I don't know, like smack each other with the clipboard or throw a book or something like that. And then they do it. And you're like, this seems obvious to me as like an adult who, you know, acculturated in this like a professional environment sort of situation. They just like don't seem to know the reasons, but that, you know, sometimes also the specific behaviors that were like, oh, those are duh behaviors. And then they don't do it. And we're like, how dare they?
Yeah. Something on that too, with like gaslighting ourselves, is just only telling students what not to do rather than demonstrating what to do. And I might have a girl boss about that later, but yeah, just, these are the reasons why we're doing, I'm asking you to do this because this. And I've had a longstanding thought that students really want to know why we're doing things, just like the long-term I can do this at the end of the year, but like want to know how it's building. Because as we know, just like people in general are very, tend to be short-sighted. So what's in it for me now? So trying to explain like, yeah, here's why we're doing this for the long term, but in the short term, this is why it's important.
So Kay, you proposed the idea of talking about positive classroom environment and then also shared that some of your thinking about this topic came from an unlikely source, which was dog training. Take us on that journey. How did that inspire your thinking about positive classroom environment, and where has it taken you now?
So I've been teaching for 14 years. And so listening to what you were sharing about, I think I'm funny, or like I'm trying this activity that the kids think is kind of cute, but aren't really like getting, totally resonates, because that was me, you know, all along. But like Ben said, my thinking around building positive classroom environments really kind of changed. My husband and I adopted our dog in April 2020. And she is, you know, a pandemic pup, didn't get out much, and has what you might call fear-based reactivity, which is she's scared of other dogs. And it comes across as she'll bark and lunge on the leash. And it's her way of saying, like, I'm afraid, so stay away from me. She's trying to, you know, get distance. She is a large dog and I am a small human. And I was like, I need to find a way to like stop this, right? And so I went down the rabbit hole of following dog trainers on social media and trying to figure out what can I do in the middle of a pandemic where we can't go out and, you know, do things in person. And so I kind of stumbled across what is called positive reinforcement, or sometimes it's spelled R+, all sometimes called force-free. And it's a way of training, but it's more than just a training method. So it's not just a fun like thing that you do. I'm really starting to think that it's like a philosophy. It's a way of thinking. Some people call it a whole way of being, that really shifts your mindset and how we approach building classroom environments. In dog training, it's this whole philosophy that you prioritize the learner, in this case, the animal's welfare. It really emphasizing understanding the animal's needs and contexts. And it puts a huge burden on the dog owner, the dog trainer. In our context as teachers, the instructor, it puts the burden on us to stay curious and be able to identify what is the behavior that we're seeing, what are the contexts where we're seeing that behavior, what are the skills that the learner is lacking that I, the instructor, need to proactively teach, and how do I set up the entire environment to predispose that learner for success. And then the positive part is you are rewarding the desired behaviors. So a lot of this is very similar to PBIS, which I know is more common in elementary schools, but it's positive behaviors, intervention, supports. And it really focuses on a lot of these same concepts, welfare or, you know, social emotional learning. I just want to mention positive reinforcement in the dog training world has a lot of crossover with like large animal trainers. There's a lot of sources of people who like train dolphins to detect underwater mines for the US Navy, or people who work in zoos and train, you know, the lions and tigers and bears, oh my, to, you know, like come get their teeth cleaned or things like that. You can't use force against big animals like that. And fun fact, people think cats are untrainable, but it's just that cats don't learn from punishment. And we live in a very punishment or, you know, compliance-based society. So this is a big shift, thinking about how do we set up the environment? How do we look at the whole context and not just like stop that behavior, stop what you're doing? But I think like Bill said, it's about what do I want you to do instead, right? Teaching those behaviors. So for me, positive reinforcement training for my dog has really helped me consider if I'm willing to do all of this for my dog, and then I walk in my classroom and I'm like, whoa, that is like not what I'm doing with my human students. It took a lot of thinking and a lot of self-reflection. It takes a lot of humility, right? Like you try something new and you take, or I find myself falling back into these old practices of, you know, you're doing something, you use proximity or redirection or one-on-ones, or if it's escalating, you send them to the office, you put in a referral, or you're contacting families. But none of that really addresses the why is the student doing this? If behavior is a communication of a need, What is the need that's not getting met? And how do I, as the teacher, help address that as best I can? So that's kind of the whole big picture of what got me going on this.
Incredible. I'm thinking about, I wrote down a couple of things that you had said. The first thing is a fear-based reactivity. And I think of sometimes the reactions that I see in students when we start using, for instance, high levels of target language, is that, you know, like it is so unusual from their nature, which is to speak their native language, right? To speak the language of schools, you know, English, to just be like, no, in here, I only do this. And I think that because language is so fundamental to our identities, I could see a fear-based reaction to that. And so I think that some of the behaviors that we see early on, like in lower level courses with novices who don't have a lot of language in their system yet, could be a fear. And, you know, preparing for that and accommodating for that is going to make that outcome a lot better for them as well as for the vibe in your class.
Yeah. Something that I was thinking about earlier today was, I know there's like different opinions on whether or not to use like bell ringers, do nows, whatever. I think though that it can be a nice gentle way to ease the students into the language for the day. Like just kind of a reminder, like, hey, we're in Spanish class. I was thinking about how I was trying to do more retrieval practice. And why is it important that you don't look back at your notes during that time? I was like, because I want you to get back into the space. I want you to start using your Spanish brain, pull out what you can, and then so we can get into class. And today I like reused what they did the bell ringer for. Like it was like a, what do you remember from the other day? And then they used those summary sentences later. And I thought that was kind of like a model that I should try to do more. That not only here get your head into the right space for class, but also let's make sure to bring that back as well to show that like what you brought in today is useful.
So once you identified this like as a system and a philosophy, and I can attest via personal experience that Kay's dog is very lovely and a sweet angel baby from heaven. So when you started thinking about training baby Raven in this way, and then applying kind of those lessons learned to your classes, where did that take you?
Yeah. I mean, like a simple example would be like I'm sure we've all had it, like the kid who you're like, okay, it's time to write. And the student walks up and goes to sharpen their pencil and talks to, you know, 1800 people on their way over, which is a feat when you have 36 in the room. And so maybe you're talking to this kid about, you know, please stop disrupting class, you know, whatever, right? And maybe this student does this all the time. Maybe nothing you're trying is working, right? Even if you like go sharpen your pencil and sit down, don't talk to other people. And so thinking about, you know, helping Raven with her reactivity, and then thinking about my student, it would be like approaching this with curiosity. So in dog training, positive reinforcement, they talk about the ABCs. So the A is the antecedent. What is the context or like the trigger that is causing the behavior? So for the student, it would be, maybe you have to figure it out, but maybe it's that you're asking them to write, right? So maybe you have to talk to the other teachers that the student has, and you find out the kid is doing this in all their classes. But if you only label the kid as, quote, disruptive or, quote, defiant for not doing what you're saying, you would not really be able to identify the antecedent, the context where this behavior shows up is you're asking them to write. And the behavior is they're maybe avoiding the task. They're getting their peers' attention. They've got your attention while you're talking to you. And they end up not having to write, or they're losing out on writing time, so they don't have to write as much. And so maybe, you know, that's the consequence. That would be the C. And that's not like a negative consequence, but they're getting something out of that behavior. And it's rewarding them. So it's this self-perpetuating cycle. So the teacher, like maybe you can identify if this only happens when I'm asking the kid to write and not when I'm asking them to turn to a partner and talk. Maybe this behavior is showing up because they lack confidence or they lack skills in being able to write. And so the intervention would be providing the student with scaffolds or having them partner up or, you know, having them provide sentence stems and do brainstorming. And then they get that social interaction by turning to a partner and sharing ideas before they have to sit down and write. And so for me, working with my dog and being like, what's your emotional state and what's the underlying reasons that you're acting like this? Instead of just being annoyed or embarrassed that he's doing this in public, And then being able to transfer that to my human students to be like, everything that you're doing is most likely not to annoy me, right? It has nothing to do with me. For the most part, I believe my students are, you know, not malicious, staying up at night plotting ways to bother me. And so for me, that's kind of the mindset. And it does take a lot of energy to not just fall back on the, will you just sit down? Will you just stop talking? But really trying to figure out what it is that the kid is trying to get out of what they're doing.
I love the thoughtfulness and the reflection that is inherent in that. That is an important part of our profession generally. But turning that sort of generosity and thought towards the humans in front of us is super important. And I think it's easy to get caught up in the nitty gritty of lesson planning and what language was used and quote taught instead of, you know, thinking about the little humans in front of us every day. Please, please ungatekeep for us your advice. If we want to make classroom environments that are positive for students, that are thoughtful and reflective and responsive, what are some things that we can do?
One thing to consider in all of this is that when we are thinking about our learners and prioritizing their welfare and well-being, it's really about focusing on our relationship between them as the learner and us as the teacher. And I really feel like this comes from a place of love, and it can't be from a place of like compliance or do this because I am the teacher, do this because I say so, do this because I have the power in our relationship. And so again, this whole idea of positive reinforcement training in dogs to me is really similar to like trauma-based instruction or culturally responsive teaching. And it really comes from a place of prioritizing that relationship and really wanting the welfare of that individual. And it's not, positive reinforcement isn't just a technique that's going to like, quote, work. It's not just a tool, which we have lots of tools in our toolbox. But thinking about, you know, what has worked and what I've learned, positive reinforcement being a mindset, right? A way of being how I show up in the world, in my classroom. First and foremost is reminding myself that I am a teacher in our existing system. And there are things that I cannot control and that I cannot change. So approaching this with a sense of grace and, you know, just understanding I'm going to be trying things. It's different for me and it's really different for the students. They may not respond right away because they'll have no idea. They're like, what the heck are you doing? This is odd, right? I think some ideas to consider first is really focusing on building a democratic classroom. So positive reinforcement dog training focuses on encouraging the dog's agency and choice. Dogs are, you know, captive animals. They're pets that we humans get a lot to decide about. And students in our classrooms have some parallels. There's a lot of things they don't have control over. So building that foundation and that environment from the first day, you know, things like co-creating classroom agreements, setting up self-service stations for supplies. I have recently learned this from a colleague. It like blows my mind. Why should a student have to ask me where the tape is or if they can get another pencil? If they know where those things are, it can build their own sense of, oh, I know how to do this and I can do it on my own. And then teaching routines, right? Where do you turn in your papers? Where's the hall room pass? When can you take breaks? Even just letting students know that they can advocate for themselves. Like I tell my students, if you are having a bad day, please tell me and I can not call on you. You can sit outside of the circle. You can, you know, only work with preferred people for the day. Really being proactive about making sure our students know that they have agency and being able to access that, I think is like one major starting point. Another one, again, that comes from, you know, thinking about an individual's welfare is just thinking about basic needs, right? Do you have policies in your classroom for students? Are they allowed to eat or drink? Can they not? Our students, I have fans in my room and students know that they can go turn them on or turn them off and they can make the fans like a tornado or they can make them really like not windy. So they have control over all of that within reason. And then just some of the neuroscience, right? Students, I've heard they have like an attention span that's about 1 minute per their how old they are. So if you're lecturing for 20 minutes, that's too long. Building in movement breaks, of course, hitting all the different skill areas, balancing group activities versus individual activities. And then as the teacher, it's my job to accommodate these needs proactively from the planning stage. So a fail is when I don't think about that until in the moment, and then I get flustered and you're like, I don't know what to do, this isn't working. And so just being intentional about that from the beginning. ABCs, so really staying curious. I know when I'm getting agitated by a student's behavior, it's super easy to just react and be like, why are you doing that? Why don't you just? But really stepping back and thinking about what is causing the behavior, what is the context, what exactly is it that the student is doing, and trying to be as descriptive as possible. And then what is the consequence? Like, what is the student getting that they might want? And I found in my district, we have to fill out forms for students on IEs and we're behavior tracking. A lot of this is useful for any student where I'm seeing some sort of behaviors that I would like to not see, but it helps me to stay curious and ask these questions. Two more is I have a hashtag on my Instagram that's hashtag my students are dogs. subtitle, and so are yours. But in the best of ways, dogs don't have morals. They don't know right from wrong, right? I like to think of my students as, again, not doing things intentionally to annoy me, or they don't stay up at night plotting the destruction of my self-esteem. And like young children also don't have morals. We have to teach them that, right? Older students, they're supposed to know, but we're also part of their continuing education of what is right and wrong and acceptable and not. And so reminding myself to consider my students' behavior from like a very neutral lens. Even when they're really angry, I had a student say, I hate your effing class. You know, just leave me the bleep alone. And I was able to just be like, wow, it sounds like you're having a really hard time. I don't appreciate you saying that to me. Let's go out and talk about it. But reminding myself, it had nothing to do with me. He had so much going on and something else was motivating his behavior, right? It had nothing, it was not me. And so reminding myself that I'm the adult in the room and I have the fully developed prefrontal cortex. I need to control my own emotions. Otherwise, I can't expect my students to do that. And my response in that moment, like, says more about who I am than about what they just did. And anything that I do in response to a student's behavior can either strengthen our relationship or damage it. And again, if I'm prioritizing my relationships with my students as part of that positive classroom environment, that's where I really need to spend all my energy. And then the last tip is being willing to stay self-reflective. Like, you're trying something new and we want our students to take risks and make mistakes and learn from those mistakes. And if we are not willing to do the same, like, we'll never be able to keep pushing ourselves and growing. So, you know, if something doesn't work, I have to ask myself, what could I have done differently? How could I have set up the environment or structured that activity to encourage student success? Or how can I back up and reteach that skill? If a student is failing a task, rather than blaming them, the student is lazy, they're unmotivated, they don't care. Maybe asking myself, was it too hard? Was it too confusing? What barriers did that individual student have that they couldn't overcome, and how can I help them? And then, you know, it's happened. We can't take risks as teachers except in front of an audience, which is really scary. But if an entire lesson falls flat, like, don't blame yourself. I ask myself, you know, what barriers did I not anticipate facing that prevented me from being successful? And then reminding myself, I have a huge network of support. Who can I turn to bounce some ideas off of or get some support for myself?
If you do that enough, you might accidentally start a podcast. Again, speaking from experience. Thank you so much for this. My brain is whirring and I'm taking little notes on my notebook in front of me. I think I started thinking about some problems in quotation marks that I've been having and started kind of trying to reframe through this positive. I'm thinking of things like blurting in English. Maybe they don't know what to say in the target language. They don't know how to contribute in the target language. Can you give them something like a rejoinder to say, or, you know, even just the sentence to say, you know, sentence frame, sentence starters, those sorts of things, and keep them readily available so they can lean on them. Maybe they have them in their notebook in front of them. Maybe they're posted on the walls, that sort of, or just part of the activity. But I think also the other one that has been making me confused lately has been the, you know, I say, turn and talk to your partner about this and either come to a decision or find some commonalities, that sort of thing. And they just like, won't. And I'm like, huh? And sometimes I've had some more success by being like, oh, they don't know how to like initiate a conversation, like with someone they don't know, right? And they feel that not knowing them is a barrier to having the conversation at all. So they just don't. And both of them are like in agreement that that's the better outcome. Like it's fine. I didn't want to talk to anyone I didn't know. So like, it's chill that we just sit next to each other. And so, you know, scripting for them, hello, How are you today? Oh, I'm good, thank you. How are you? You know, and then they have like the wheel is greased a little bit so that when they ask the actual question I'm trying to get them to ask, that they like have already started a conversation and they don't have to, you know, be the one to get the momentum. And maybe even starting the entire class saying those words at the exact same time so that there's no, you know, no escape, no escape. What are some other girl bosses that we came out of K's gatekeeping, ungatekeeping?
Like finding out the antecedent of some behaviors. Like I know that this year I've had some classes not be as participatory as I would like them to be. And something that I've just very recently started, so I don't have the habit yet, but like when I ask an open-ended question and I don't get any responses, instead of just waiting for someone to just speak up, I finally have started asking like, oh, like, is it like una falta de horas, like a lack of words, or una falta de ideas, a lack of ideas? Because either one I can help with, but let me know which one, where the problem is.
Yeah, I think in justifying our own behaviors, like we're asking these open-ended questions, or we're asking, you know, maybe if you're asking a whole class core question, that we're doing it for a reason. And you know, I've said something to the effect too of like, when you don't respond, I either think that you're just really tired and you're just trying to like not respond, or I think you don't get it. And so I'm going to ask again, just to be clear, which one of those ones it is. And usually the core response is way stronger because they, you know, they got the inertia of just not responding. Right. So yeah, the curiosity and but also explaining the curiosity, like, I'm interested in that thing you just did, kiddos. Like, what's going on here?
I think that in terms of like my classroom management and things like that, like just what you were saying about just trying to understand the antecedent and being curious about like what is causing the student to do whatever they're doing has really helped a lot, because I remember a time a long time ago where it's just like, it's the rule, you have to do what I say, and the teacher, whatever, because that's what my teacher did. But then I think just more in recent years, I've just been like, before I say something, I have to like stop myself and like just wonder what could be going on for that student. Or like, I might even prepare like some questions I might ask them if I have to pull them out in the hall or something like that. And I often, what I do now is like, I'll take, like if I do have to take a student out, for example, I will just say, first of all, why have I taken you out of the classroom? And I have them like kind of, and 9 times out of 10, they know what they did. And then I just ask more questions. So like, do you think that was a good idea? Is that helping, you know, is this making this a fun class for everyone? Is this helping you learn or not? And usually they can come up with the answers on their own. And it feels so much less confrontational. And so I think that has contributed to just building better relationships with my students, because I haven't had a power struggle with a student in like years.
In the world that I used to work in, a summer camp world, and they likened a power struggle to essentially like a tug of war with a rope. And you just have to drop the rope. You just have to let it go, right? Like you just have to say, I'm not going to be party to this petty squabble. I'm just going to appeal to their reason as like a human person and be like, I think you know that the government pays me to teach you German or French or Spanish or Japanese. And like, when this happens in class, I can't really do that. And, you know, kids are like, oh yeah, like totally that. It's like, you can't really, but if it was like, you offended my sensibilities as like a human and I think you should know what to do, it's like, yeah, you're not gonna like, sure. Like, but then, you know, students might interpret it as like you yelling at them as opposed to having a conversation with them. And then what does that get is that they come away from the class being like, well, the teacher yelled at me today. Even if you said things that were literally true that you witnessed with your eyes. No, I wasn't talking. Well, that's interesting because my auditory senses said otherwise while also looking at you and seeing your mouth move. But do you want to win that battle? Like, do you want to like punk a 15-year-old and like, got him? Like maybe examine that need in yourself as well.
I'm taking this class called Leadership as Reflective Practice. So been a lot on my mind. And so like some practices that maybe could be good to share with everyone, and especially kind of like in this moment, these kind of like tense moments, especially, or potential for tension, the different categories that we can like reflect into are like, am I being mindful of the situation? Did I take a moment first to before I responded? Like self-awareness, like, am I aware of myself? Am I angry right now? Is that going to come out? in this interaction, checking our attitudes. Where am I taking this in a positive way? Am I trying to take it in a negative way? Creativity, like, do I have to take a straightforward response to this, or can I figure out an alternative way? And then finally, which I think is really what's kind of been helping me a lot recently, is being true to yourself and like actually finding out who you are and what is it that is okay and what is not okay to you in this learning environment where you're trying to teach students. And I've just been like very, very reflective on this recently, and it's helped me be very calm. It's helped me accept like, yeah, not every single day is going to be bright and shiny, and being reflective on the environment that we are setting up for our students. So on that, do you think you have any potential guiding questions that you use when you're thinking about a situation in class?
I definitely say it's still not automatic for me. A lot of times this reflection for me happens after the moment, right? Like in the moment something has happened, maybe I'm trying to just reduce harm, like respond in a way that is reminding the student I care about them, prioritizing our relationship, but also giving me space to step back and think about it. So sometimes these questions are me in the shower later that night, or me trying to go to bed and I was like, oh my God, I think I understand, right? But a lot of times I like what Brian said about, you know, if you have to pull a kid in the hallway or if you're giving them that space for one-on-one, approaching it with a, can you tell me what's going on right now? Right? Inviting them into that conversation, reminding them they have agency and I'm not just there to like smack them down about what they did that was wrong. And, you know, if I have that conversation with that student, great, because then that's the question I lead with. Can you tell me why we're out here? Can you tell me what's going on? If it's just me thinking about, okay, that kid is doing that thing again, maybe trying to think about what can I do in the moment to prevent them from disrupting the class and giving them some space so maybe they can figure out what they need. I often will reach out to other teachers and ask, are you seeing this specific behavior in your different classes? But again, that starts with me being curious about what it is that I'm seeing and trying to be descriptive. I think those are the questions I might start with.
Something that I've been trying to do with establishing like a classroom, a positive classroom environment, is attaching the desired behaviors or like the appropriate behaviors to our school values and saying like, hey, you all are insert mascot. This is who you are when you're here. And these are the things that we as a community have said that we value. And maybe we need to update them. That's fine. That happens all the time. We update our values. But when you started this school year, you knew what we expected, what kind of values we have. So like if the value is like honesty, yeah, make sure that you're like, it's not that you don't cheat because cheating is wrong. You don't cheat because that's not a value that we hold, because that's dishonesty. And I think I've seen some positive improvements, outcomes from that.
I love that idea of tying it to the school values. I'm thinking about like when we co-create agreements, it could be tied to something like that. Like we agreed in our classroom to look this way. Or if you have school values and you build your class agreements around that, or like PBIS in my school, we have safe, respectful, responsible. They're very broad categories, but defining them, what does that look like to us? And how do we show that we are these things? Yeah. I just think that helps with the buy-in. It reminds the kids like, You are a part of the environment, right? You are the most important part of this environment in a lot of ways.
And like I've given quite a few like example behaviors, which is overwhelming, but I try to say like, this is not exhaustive. These are just like some very observable things that I can do for now. And I need them to be observable right now so that we can, I can see whether or not it's happening, which I think I got that from John Cowart. And it has been really game-changing, even just like for instructions, but also for like put your finger on the word that we're reading, but also with other behaviors. So my question was, how do you turn off that reflection when you're at home?
Another excellent question. I am reading, kind of a side note, I am reading the book Arise by Elena Aguilar. I'm doing a book study with the other curriculum specialists. And she is a consultant. She teaches coaches how to coach teachers. And her whole method is called transformative coaching. But she is a really big believer in your cup has to be full before you can fill someone else's cup. And we all deserve to thrive. And so a lot of what I'm getting from her book is that I need to take care of myself before I can try to help taking care of others, even if, whether that's me coaching other teachers or like in our teaching context, we're taking care of our students. So I come home and I prioritize walking my dog. Like all comes full circle, but the days where I miss walking Raven, like I don't feel really good. The doctors are all like, go do exercise and get fresh air. And ugh, the doctors, it's true.
It turns out they were right all along. I know. Yeah, I just got on a running schedule and then I'm like, wow, I feel better. Turns out.
Keeping that routine, if I come home and make sure to, take care of myself, it helps me kind of compartmentalize, right? We talked about having routines for our students to get into the, our language. I think for me, coming home and being with my dog is my, like, I am at home and I turn it off. But the routine helps me with that. Because at a certain point, reflection just becomes like self-flagellation, and that's not helpful. So I know we've talked a lot about antecedents, and we, the teacher, have a lot of power in our classroom and a big responsibility to think about what can we do to help our students, what can we do to set up the environment. And as I've been talking tonight, I think about some students I have where for them the antecedent or the context where these behavior shows up is school. Being in school is a major trigger for a lot of our students who are carrying so much emotional baggage or trauma with them. And so this goes back to having grace for ourselves, is there are things that I cannot control, and there are things that are outside of my sphere of influence to be able to support this student with. So turning to colleagues or turning to school counselors or reaching out to the students' families and guardians about, hey, these are the behaviors I'm seeing in school. This is what we're trying. What else, what other types of supports does the student have? Just reminding myself that I can't beat myself up about just the fact that school is not where everyone is thriving, and I can do what I can to help them in my little context. But for some students, that context where the behavior is in school, in presence of authority figures. So, not to end on like kind of a down note, but reminding myself there is a lot that I can influence and be positive, and maybe that student will remember, I do care about them. Even if they aren't learning Japanese, that might be like as much as they're able to do, or as much as I'm able to do for them. And reminding myself of that, I think, is important.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that's a downer at all. I mean, I think that's a good thing for all of us to remember, like, right? Like, we shouldn't really be making ourselves feel bad because we are not superheroes. We are teachers, we do the best we can. What I think about a lot is like, what I want my students to remember is that I cared about them, that they can learn a language in some form or another, and that it's important to understand people who are different. So if they can do that, down the line, I'm happy. And that can get rid of a lot of like, yeah, just the angry storm cloud over your head, thinking like constantly second guessing yourself. So I think we're just about at our time. And so I wanted to thank you so much for joining us. It's been really great listening to you and just sharing your thoughts and throwing things back and forth about like how we have seen trying to create more positive classroom environments in our own contexts. And yeah, I've definitely learned a lot.
Again, I from a personal perspective, encourage people to seek out colleagues to honor and nominate for awards and to highlight the good work that they do every day that, often goes unnoticed. And I'm just so thankful for Kate for coming on and slaying with us.
Thanks for having me. It's been awesome.
I am so glad this is recorded so I can listen to it a million times.
It was a ton of
Thanks.
fun. Thank
See
you
you
so
next time.
much. Bye.
Go forth and slay.
Bye.